ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the inaugural episode of the First In Podcast, brought to you by the VBFD. We're going to be getting this thing off the ground here. This is our first episode, but we're looking forward to having all kinds of guests on here, whether they are members of the VBFD, members of the fire service as a whole, or just some interesting conversations with people that are passionate about topics that maybe can relate to our job outside industries or experiences or whatever the case may be. My name is Andrew Conlin. I'm a captain with the Virginia Beach Fire Department. I've been in about 12 years now, and I'll be your host. And I'm looking forward to having some good chats. I think one of the best things about the fire service and the reason that we wanted to do this podcast was we have some very exciting conversations, and we all know we've been there, right? Sitting around the kitchen table, sitting on the tailboard of the truck, sitting on the truck, you know, with each other. And sometimes the best conversations are had and they don't necessarily get brought up with a larger audience. So we're trying to bring some of those passionate conversations and topics to you, to the audience. Today, we have a special guest here with us today. He is a 13-year veteran of the VBFD. He is currently the captain of Rescue 2 on the Tech Rescue Team. He is a member of Virginia Task Force 2. He's a rescue squad officer. He's a nationally registered paramedic. He's the chair of the Safety Committee. He teaches lifting and moving at the Structural Collapse School that we just hosted, and we're going to get into that a lot more today. He's also a member of the Human Performance Cadre here with the VBFD, something we're going to want to learn more about as well. And he spent several years as the captain of incumbent training for the VBFD, the one, the only, Mr. John Carver. Welcome.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
Wow, we're excited to have you. So you and I crossed paths. So you basically spent a lot of years at the Tech Rescue Team with our city, right?
Yep.
And then you and I crossed paths when you got promoted to captain and came over, and I worked for you at Company 3, which hosts our hazmat team. So you've gotten a chance to step into both worlds and get some experience there. And what was that like?
I did. Super grateful for it. I think you guys realize really quickly. First of all, I'd be remiss if I didn't compliment you on both your mustache and your recent promotion to captain. So congratulations. Well,
thank you very much. I am the least experienced captain in the fire department right now.
It's a good place
to
be.
Which is a title I can claim for a little while longer till we get the next one.
It's a good place to be.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, coming over there from Company 7 in the tech team, I thought I had a pretty good idea of the ins and outs of hazmat and how that whole gig works. And I realized very quickly that you guys had used small words and talked to us very slowly and and coached us along, and there was a lot more depth to it than I was aware of. So extremely grateful for not only the guys I got to work with over there and girls, but the experience that I got. And I think I'm probably much more well-rounded firefighter and definitely a more well-rounded rescue member for it.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So that's a big part of what we want to do with this podcast, right, is maybe shine a light on some of these areas. We have such a multifaceted department, so many areas of expertise, and, you know, we joke all the time, you can take this career and go in so many different directions with it, but there's a lot of stuff you can't possibly experience at all, and we want to have some conversations and find out, you know, maybe, hey, what's going on with, I'll be right up front with you, I don't know anything about boats. At some point, we're going to want to talk to somebody who can paddle a boat. Is that what you call it?
We got a lot of
boats. I don't know. There's somebody cringing right now on the boat team. It's not paddle. Well, reach out. firstinpodcast@vbgov.com, and you can reach out with your questions, thoughts, concerns, ideas. So as I touched on a little while ago, you were an instructor for the Structural Collapse School here in Virginia Beach.
Yeah.
What is that? Where is it? What? Tell me everything.
So Structural Collapse Technician is a requirement that's put out there by FEMA.
Okay.
And so obviously the majority of FEMA teams are going to have a robust rescue component. Those rescue components are responding to a variety of types of deployments, right? But primarily, FEMA was initially created to go to structural collapse, building collapses. You know, you had the Oklahoma City bombing. Hmm. They went to Haiti, you know, and worked on collapsed structures. That was kind of the initial birth of this team. And so Structural Collapse Technician School takes you through three disciplines: shoring, lifting and moving, and breaching and breaking. And so in each of those three disciplines, you learn how to shore up, safely enter a structure, and make it safe to access, or safe as we can. You learn how to make big rocks and little rocks and break things and safely access. And then we learn how to lift up really heavy stuff with the equipment that we've got in our cache. Most people say that it's one of the best, if not the best, classes that they've ever attended. And that's a big reflection on the guys I work with there, the instructors, and the quality of the class that's been running for, I believe we just did our 25th class this last year.
That's very exciting. To give the listeners an idea of the scope of what we're talking about here. So ballpark 130 to 150 students, is that correct?
That's correct.
And then how many in the instructor cadre?
Yeah, so this year I would be guessing on the number of instructor cadre, but I would imagine it's around 40 or 50.
Okay.
Then your students, like you said, 130 to 150. And then this year I believe they had 18 squads with, I want to say, 6 people in each squad.
Okay.
And so we also run a rescue squad officer program where each of those squads gets assigned a rescue squad officer who has previously attended this class in the basic class and mm-hmm. is now coming back to go through as an RSO. And that class is a qualification on most teams to allow you to apply to be a rescue squad officer with a FEMA team.
Sure. Yeah. One of the things that I think is exciting about a lot of the levels of training we do, and you start to see it as you move through your career, right? You start as a recruit and all you see is, oh, you know, the instructors are teaching me X, Y, Z. What you don't see until a little later is the instructors are developing themselves as they do that, right? So you're getting a chance to manage people as an instructor. You're getting a chance to lead command and develop your skills. Everybody at every level is getting to, whether they're teaching, whether they're, you know, it's easy as a student to look at it and say, oh, they've got this mastered and they're teaching it. Well, what's the old adage, right? The best way to learn something is to teach it. So what's really fun about a lot of these things is every layer of that component, whatever it might be, is developing and growing and learning, which is fantastic.
Well, I would definitely agree, because speaking for the group of guys I teach with, you know, Jason Perez, Chris Doherty, Dylan Dextrider, those guys,
of the year, Chris Doherty.
That's firefighter of the year, yeah, Chris yeah. Doherty. Those guys are developing this curriculum and planning and getting this thing ready as soon as the previous class ends. And they've introduced some stuff in our lifting and moving course over there that Paratech says nobody else is doing, talking about lifting angles and max lifts and load calcs and stuff like that. It's pretty neat. So to your point, yeah, those guys are constantly raising the bar and pushing stuff, and it's pretty cool to be a part of.
That's exciting. That's really cool. So yep. Paratech, the company that makes the product, is saying, hey, you guys are applying it in ways that we haven't seen before.
They want those guys on their podcast at some point just to explain what they're doing in this class.
We'll compete with that in a moment, yeah. But we'll come back to it.
No doubt.
So in structural collapse school, you get hands-on, like you said, you touched on it. So you get heavy lifting and moving. You get airbag operation, shoring, breaching and breaking. You get to operate cranes, correct?
Yeah.
So they bring in cranes, and even that component is touched on as a student?
Yeah, 100%. So what initially, you're getting a very basic introduction to rigging, slinging, load calculations, bolting heavy objects, slinging heavy objects, and then lifting them with a crane. You learn how to direct the crane, how to work around cranes on a pile. I was deployed to Surfside for the condo collapse, and they basically had a full-size crane on each side of that operation, plus some smaller moving equipment. Mm-hmm. And it's all just moving around you and above you. And so it gets pretty intricate. And so, yeah, it's a pretty neat part of the class. Those guys do a great job. Our heavy riggers mm-hmm. are working with guys over there, and it's pretty neat.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but you're pairing that with outside industry, correct? So it's not necessarily a firefighter. It could be a crane operator. It could be
yep.
somebody who has a skill set that applies to what we're doing, right?
Absolutely. It's one of the few areas, along with engineers, where we really get outside of the fire service, because we're not the best at everything. We like to think we're good at a lot of things, but sometimes we need the true SMEs. And so for the heavy riggers and the engineers, and a lot of the times the canine handlers, we reach outside the fire department for experts in those fields. And the cranes are definitely one of them.
Of course, yeah. We tend to be jacks of all trades and not to say masters of none, but we can be very good at a lot of things. But when somebody spends their career mastering a skill, you know, it would be foolish not to rely on that skill set.
100%.
So you were deployed to Surfside. For those that don't recall, that was in outside of Miami, just roughly. Is that correct?
Yeah.
The building collapse a few years ago?
Yep. Right there on the waterfront. And I want to say that was 3 years ago now.
It's got to be about that. Yeah.
Three, four, something like that. Four.
How long were you down there for?
Man, I think we were there for 2 weeks.
That was a long deployment.
It was a long deployment. It was an interesting deployment when we were driving down there. You know, we knew it was obviously a very legit deployment. We knew those guys had been working for 3 or 4 days on that collapse before we got activated. And on the way down, you know, everybody's getting their minds right, working through some stuff that, you know, some techniques, talking through some things that you know you're going to apply that you train on all the time, but we really don't see very much of it all in our actual deployments. And we got close down there, and they were like, well, we're trying to find a place for you guys to stay. It's Miami in the summer. It's a little busy. So we might put you up on a cruise ship. I'm like, okay, that's a good one. And then we pulled up to a cruise ship, and we said, okay. And so each of us got a berth on a cruise ship, and that's where we stayed.
You for delivered that deployment. A baby on a berth ship?
No, different spelling.
Oh, okay.
B-E-R. Yep.
It's tricky.
Yeah. But yeah, then they would drive us to the site every day. We switched into a daytime and a nighttime ops.
Okay.
So I was a day walker. And yeah, we worked there for, I think we were on the pile for 10 or 11 days.
Interesting. What, in 11 days on a deployment, what is the thing that is the biggest challenge mentally as far as staying engaged, staying locked in? You know, I imagine at some point it's got to be a wear and tear issue of keeping your mind right, keeping yourself in that mentality, staying positive in a situation like that
has
got to be really difficult. And again, having worked with you for a few years, having worked for you, I know you bring a very positive attitude to a crew. How do you bring that to something as tragic and difficult for as long as you were there for?
Yeah. So I would say that it's very, very important to have, just like with anything, it's the right people. It's the people you work with. So we had great guys and girls on that deployment. And then I think really you just lock in and go to work, and you do that for as long as you need to. And with the right people, you know, that's just what we do. And then once you were off shift and coming back, you know, you just shut it down as quick as you can. Just try to clear your mind out, sleep as much as you can, and get ready to go back and work the next day. But really, there was such a sense of purpose there. You knew exactly what you were there for. And a lot of the families that were associated with that, a lot of the community was very present, very close to that site, came by the site a lot. And so it was not difficult to stay locked in. You know, you had a real sense of that community were really, really needing you to be there. And so that made it a lot easier.
It's I'm sure a difficult time for all of them, a difficult time for all the people that were there, but also, you know, a fascinating experience. Speaking of which, you deployed more recently to North Carolina, is that correct?
We did.
Okay. Tell me more about that.
So this was an interesting deployment, and for a lot of reasons. We went out for a hurricane deployment, which is one of our most common deployments right now. And we went to Florida, went to Orlando, and that's a very familiar deployment for us. Make the drive down 95, get to the Orlando Convention Center, set up, and we try to get down there prior to the storm hitting now. That's a model that FEMA adopted a couple years ago that's very effective because it gets you in the right place early on. So we got to Orlando, waited for the storm to hit. The storm hit, and it did not impact Florida as significantly as maybe initially expected. So we were there. We were attached to Florida, so we went to work and started surveying areas, checking on neighborhoods, marking damaged houses, stuff like that. And then very quickly, we'd wrapped up the work that was down there, and we're hearing all these reports about North Carolina just having been devastated in the Asheville area and everything. So we're like, man, in a perfect world, we're done with work here. They would clear us up and send us there. And then they did. We're like, wow, okay.
Yeah.
So drove straight through to North Carolina, got some orders on the way. And when we got there, we went to work there. And it was pretty surreal to see the amount of devastation, flooding damage, tornado damage in a mountain area. It's just, it's not something that I've ever worked in my experience with FEMA. But super glad we got there as quick as we did, because everywhere we went was first access to little mountain areas, mountain neighborhoods, you know, where roads have been blocked 2-3 miles deep with hundreds and hundreds of trees, you know, 2-3 feet across that just covered the roads, impassable. Obviously, you had all the flooding, all the buildings destroyed in the towns that had been, you know, wiped down river. And so we started surveying up and down roads, cutting trees, making access to areas that had not been accessed yet. We did that for 2 or 3 days. And then what they quickly recognized was there were whole areas of these towns and then outside of towns along the water where roads were impassable. They were not able to access them by any way other than air, which they still didn't have really any place to land, or boats. And so they came to us and they said, hey, we need you guys to run some legit whitewater in your paddlecraft, your whitewater boats, and it's the only way to access it. So we need you to run this white water and search. And that was pretty wild. As far as I'm aware, nobody's done that before.
Yeah.
So we put some boats in the water and we searched, I'd be making up a number, but I think it was over 40, 45 miles of river running whitewater paddle craft and running it till you could stop and slow down, get off to the side, search an area, get back in and keep going. That was pretty different.
So you were changing your strategy and tactics as you were going, essentially. So I imagine, like anyone else, the mountainous area of North Carolina is not expecting to be flooded. No. That was a big part of, you know, when you look at this event, you know, the, like you said, you've been to Florida before, right? Mm-hmm. So there are areas of our country that, you know, are very familiar with flooding, whether it's along the Gulf Coast or whatever the case may be. So when you had to deploy within the mountain, what was the conversation like in terms of on scene, hey, we need to change what we generally do? Was it, we need to rely on different tactics, or were you and the team coming up with unknown tactics up until this point and just relying on the ingenuity of the people on scene?
Well, so we're pretty fortunate. I think our team is really proactive in a lot of ways. And one of the things that we have done is we've done a good amount of land nav, of wide area search. We're comfortable with operating, you know, on foot in large areas and stuff like that. One thing that we ran into there that was pretty new, relatively new to us as a team, was we had almost no comms because the mountains disrupt all cell service. Plus, obviously, a lot of that stuff was down. Our radios that we would normally set up in an area to create our own radio channels, they just don't work in that kind of area. So a lot of what we did there had to be making a plan in the morning, a morning brief, and then we would send out 7 or 8 teams in different vehicles. And those teams just had to operate autonomously all day. And if you ran into something where someone needed medical attention or needed an evacuation or a specific issue, each of those teams really had to operate on their own, make some decisions on their own. And because we have the right people, that was really effective. So it was good.
No, that's a great example of, you know, you got to trust your guys on the ground. Trust that you have the right people in the right positions and let them go to work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I do want to throw out too, this was a deployment where it was the first time that we've ever really interacted with the community the way that we did there. And they set us up in Mitchell Middle School. And a lot of that whole community obviously was deeply affected by this. There were a lot of teachers that were trying to make it into the school and assist with a lot of the stuff that was going on. And that school was made a donation center. So people were bringing in just truckloads and truckloads of supplies, dropping it here, and it was being given out. And we had some guys on the team, Tony Wilson in particular, that figured out a way to organize that whole system and then set it up so when people came by and they needed something. And it was absolutely like the most like forward-facing, like positive contact with a community that I've had the chance to have on a deployment. It was pretty neat. They were really appreciative, and you left really feeling like you'd done some really good stuff.
Oh, it's spectacular. I mean, that's the point, right? Is to have a positive impact on, you know, fellow Americans.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, I mean, it's a national team to try and help one another. It's fantastic.
Yeah, it was good.
So that was Hurricane Helene that came through, correct?
Yep.
Yeah. And then how long was the team deployed total? So you went to Florida, you went to North Carolina. So from portal to portal, as you guys say.
Yeah.
How long were you deployed for?
19 days.
19 days.
Yep.
Is that in the canon of team deployments, where does that land? That sounds long.
It's by far my longest.
Okay.
I think the previous longest I'd been out was, I want to say, 16 days. When you deploy, you're deploying, committing to a 14-day time period.
Okay.
And then anything after that, if you're basically, they'll check in. They'll say, hey, is everybody good? Is everybody good to stay longer? Do you need to stay longer? You got anything with family? And if you need to rotate guys out, you will.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, this one was by far the longest I've been on.
Interesting. So we're going to, unless there's anything else you'd like to add to that topic?
No.
All right.
Covered it.
So what we're going to do now, we're going to transition to a segment we're going to have here on the podcast. And basically what I want to know is, what is something you're passionate about? Right. So whenever we get into these conversations, you know, I was telling this story, you know, whether it's a documentary or a conversation about fire tactics, it almost doesn't matter what the topic is if somebody's passionate about it. I want to hear more. The 30 for 30s that ESPN does, right? So they're fascinating. Even if it's a subject, great documentary. I might not have anything to knowledge on the topic, but I got sucked into the Tanya Harding ice skating documentary.
Okay.
Didn't know anything about it. My wife was asking me a question and I was like, shh, shh, shh. She's like, did you just shush me for figure skating? I said, yes. I'm trying to see the end of this. So what I want to hear from each of our guests is what's that thing that lights you up, right? When you're sitting at the table, what's that topic that makes you sit up a little straighter and go, hey, yeah, let's get your fire burning, no pun intended, right? What's something that gets you passionate?
You know, the first thing that popped on mind is probably human performance as it relates to us and our job.
Okay.
It's something that we're trying to get better at, get a little deeper into, because it's easy to just throw out human performance, right? And just say, well, we'll just be better at stuff. But the more that you get into it and the more that you realize that it covers everything from, realistic training to nutrition, to sleep, to like cognitive behavior, to just all of the stuff that you do both on and off the job to make yourself better. And we've been, like, as a human performance cadre, like you touched on earlier, trying to get a little deeper into that and just do our due diligence and find out, because the fire service is relatively, I think, new at looking at that. I think we're really good at, we need the best gear, we need the best trucks, we need to try to train, as much as we can. But the human performance and maybe the human element of that, I don't feel like we touch on a ton, but I like that we're looking at it a lot more recently, and that's pretty cool.
Now, you're saying that's pairing, like, psychological factors, biological factors, environmental factors, all those things coming together, correct?
I would say so. Like, obviously, if you're listening and you're not familiar with what a NIOSH report is, a NIOSH report generally is written if someone is seriously injured or killed in the line of duty. And I read a study recently by Leadership Under Fire, which is a really, really cool group at FDNY, and they do a great job. But they wrote a paper basically looking at how NIOSH reports look at everything but the human factor. And when you look at what we do on the fire ground, the human factor is a massive part of it. Your ability to intake information quickly in the midst of a whole lot of chaos, make a split-second decision based on the information you have at that moment, and then fall back to your basic level of training and make it work. Obviously, if a NIOSH report doesn't take those things into account, then it's missing a massive part of why things probably played out the way they did. And so a big part of what we're trying to do in the VBFD with human performance is, how can you get ahead of that? How can you get ahead of the curve, help people to learn how to handle stress, how to prep for that stuff, how to take care of themselves, so when that moment arises, you've prepared for it and can hopefully, I almost said rise to the level, but I think everybody knows, I love the phrase, you don't rise to the level of expectation, you fall to your level of training. So
yeah.
We're trying to raise that level of training.
Speaking of which, how early on are you implementing some of these techniques with the VBFD?
So that's pretty cool. We've got a lot of support from our senior staff on this recently. So they've allowed us to insert a human performance class into the recruit academy, and it's done the week prior to them entering SCBA week, which for our recruits is probably the most intense test early on in the academy, as you're aware, because you've been to training also. It's the first time that these guys are, it's not the first time they're put in gear or on air, but it's the first time that it's done with expectations and with manufactured stress and time hacks and the requirement to perform. And so we were allowed to introduce this class about a week or so ahead of time and give them some tips and tricks, start talking about visualization, mindset, breathing techniques. We touch on a little bit of meditation, the need for sleep and correct nutrition and all the different ways that you can prepare yourself to be successful. And then we basically tell them, we're giving you all these tools that lots of people have never had before at this point in their academy. And so we're raising the bar for you. And the expectation is not the same as it was, it's higher. And now that you've been given all this stuff, the expectation is that you perform if you want to be here. And I really like it. It's been a good thing.
No, it was fantastic to see a lot of those techniques get explained, a lot of those tools given to those recruits, right? Because it puts them in a better position to succeed, which ultimately is what we want out of those recruits, right? So again, from their perspective, it's probably the instructional cadre in a fire academy is looking for failure, and it's almost by design, right? It's using manufactured stress. It's using that pressure to find out how you're going to perform under stress. And like you said, a lot of people coming before maybe weren't given those tools and had to figure it out in the moment. But ultimately, what we want is success there. We want to find people and can come into this fire service and be successful. So that was, that was very exciting to see for sure.
Yeah.
Where do you see the program going from here?
So only as long as it continues to get supported in the way that it has, I truly believe that it's just going to get better and better. We just sent 3 of our members of the Human Performance Cadre to the Leadership Under Fire retreat, actually the week before last. All speaking for myself, it's the best fire-related training that I've ever been to. It's just immersive. It's from firefighters from all different, we had different countries. When I went, we had some firefighters from Denmark. And it's just this immersive experience about bettering yourself, self-development, leadership, stuff like that. But if we continue to send our cadre to things like that, to members of the VBFD, to outside training, I think a big part of what we've done is bring outside speakers in. We had Jason Redman here. Last year, we had a sports psychologist that came and spoke at one of our officer in services. We've done a lot of things to try and better our members. And I think as long as we're willing to continue to do that and prioritize it, then what we deliver in this class is going to continue to get better and better. One of the things that I'm really excited that we were able to do is we've worked on ice bath immersion, both with our recruits. And we also do this at the 3-year mark with our members who are getting ready to drive. Because a lot of studies, you know, will tell us that the 2 most stressed members on the fire ground are that first due battalion and the first due driver.
Oh, yeah.
So we've started taking our guys through that. And a lot of the ice bath stuff is one of the best ways to manufacture stress and then breathe through it, respond to it. And so we've introduced that as a part of this program. But between delivering it to the recruits at the 3-year mark and at the 6-year mark before you get ready as a master firefighter in Virginia Beach to be able to ride up front of a truck, be in charge of a truck, I think that we're really providing guys with some tools that I'll sit here and tell you I wish that I'd had at that point in my career.
So yeah, absolutely.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah, if you haven't tried the ice bath yet, it is absolutely a shock to the system, both mentally and physically. Oh, God, this guy sitting across from me convinced me to do it, and I'm not sure he was my friend in that moment. I don't know.
But you did it.
But I did it. Right. I did it. I tried it.
That's right.
It's something. All right. Is there anything else that fires you up, that makes you passionate? What else in towards the end of this episode here, is there anything you feel like talking about?
Well, I know something that's near and dear to both of our hearts.
Oh.
Hey, everybody's out of the structure.
Oh, all right.
And I'd be remiss if we didn't at least touch on it in this podcast.
Let's get into it. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think culturally, I think that fire departments move in large groups, right? I think that culturally I would like to say that although everybody knows that each crew is different, each station is different.
Sure.
A lot of that depended on, you know, your officer and your senior masters and how they drive and respond to that crew culturally. But I do believe that one of the things that I think the line is always moving back and forth within your department is how aggressive you are with search tactics, with fire attack tactics, and what your department commonly accepts as is okay. I'm curious if you agree. I would like to think that we're a fairly aggressive interior fire attack and search department.
I think so, yeah.
I think we've gotten a lot of support from our senior staff since I've been here to continue to be that way, to be what the citizens are expecting us to be.
Absolutely.
Which is to prioritize them and to go take care of business, to be good at what we do, to get there quickly and to get inside quickly. One of the things that I can't stand, and I know you can't either, is hey, we're being told everybody's out of the house.
Right.
And I think it's hilarious because we say that on the radio. You and I try not to, but I know right. That gets said. And the expectation is that we're going to somehow operate differently because some random person in the yard told us everybody's out of the house.
Right.
And that's funny because when a residential alarm goes off in the city of Virginia Beach, if someone calls to cancel it, what do?
We still go.
We still send a truck. How come?
We don't know if that's accurate.
Because we don't know if that's accurate. But
until one of us puts eyes on it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But this house that has fire through the roof and this guy in the front yard who we don't know if he lives there, knows anything about
anything.
Could
be the neighbor. Oh, yeah, they're not home today.
They're not home. Okay, yeah. Cool. And you and I both know how many reports are out there of, hey, everybody's out of the house reports followed by somebody getting pulled out of the house, right?
If you ever want to go down a rabbit hole, and I know you and I both have, The most recent one I've seen, I haven't seen one more recent than last month, not that that goes back very far, was St. Paul, Minnesota. There were three teenagers came out somewhere. The ages are, you know, I think the oldest was 17, but there were three teenagers came out, told the first responding unit, hey, everybody's out of the house. Their father was still inside the house, was found on a primary search.
Yeah.
So, and it's not to say it's malicious. I don't mean that to imply that it's a nefarious report that they're like trying to get somebody hurt.
No.
But somebody that is running from their home on fire is not thinking clearly, may not be fully aware of the information, may not be aware that dad was, there's so many variables that can roll into that. I believe it was the latest statistics, it's somewhere in the ballpark. It's 22% of victim reports are inaccurate one way or the other. So, okay. Again, that's from, the firefighter close call survey. Am I saying that correctly?
Yep.
Yeah. So they've, and I believe the group of calls they compared that to is up to 4,000 calls. So when we talk about 22% of what, it's 20% 4,000 calls that involved a rescue.
Yeah.
Which that's a lot of inaccurate information.
Yeah.
And then ultimately it's just a question of if it's capable of being searched, we should search it.
100%.
With our gear and our training, if we can occupy that space, we should search it and expect to find somebody there.
Yeah.
Until we go in and verify otherwise.
Yeah.
I think that's the biggest thing is if you get on the radio and say, everybody's out of the house, we're still going to do the search, right? Yep. I don't think anybody, at least in our department, is going to say, well, we won't do a primary search.
Correct.
We're still going to do a primary search. It's that, again, human performance. It's that psychological nugget that it puts in everybody's head of, if everybody's out, the expectation is we're not going to find victims.
Yeah.
And we should be rolling into every primary search with the expectation of finding victims. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Expect fire, expect victims.
Expect fire, expect victims. Yeah. And if we find out otherwise, fantastic. We don't want victims, but we are going to operate as if my family is in that structure. And I'd like to think our whole department would too.
Yeah.
So what is, what I know basically what our argument would be is that basically is that if that information is received, it's not repeated on the radio. Is that correct?
I think that would be my goal. And I agree with you that I think the vast majority of guys in our department will hear that information if it's put out over the radio and still operate correctly.
Sure.
But I do think we should recognize that there is an element of human performance, like you said, that's going to take your foot off the gas just a little bit. Mm-hmm. And you may not check behind that door. It may affect someone's operational tactics differently. And it's just one of those things that I think if we could either eliminate or look at it and address it realistically with the, hey, if you're going to say that this is being reported to you, then hopefully we're training our guys. And I know that in a lot of instances we're training our guys to understand that that report is not a credible report.
Right.
Until, hey, primary is complete, nothing found.
Right.
Yep. So.
All right. Well, this was a lot of fun. Glad we could have you down for the inaugural podcast, episode number one. And we're looking forward to having a lot of fun conversations on here. If you have any questions for us, if you have any ideas, if you have anybody, I would love to hear from somebody who maybe has a recommendation. You know, hey, this person is really knowledgeable, really passionate. They would be a great person to come on and talk about something. Recommend them. Shoot, throw them right under the bus. I'll come find them.
Perfect.
And like I said, firstinpodcast@vbgov.com. And we're looking forward to seeing you next time. Have a good one.